Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and we're in the heart chapter. We'll finish that up pretty quick, I think, today, and then move on to circulatory system. And so we'll just be slightly ahead of schedule, which is okay, because usually we fall behind somewhere along the line. So we'll fall behind sometime and catch back up in a certain way of thinking about things. All right, so your next test is next week, but not on Monday, but on Wednesday of next week, right? The 17th. And that's going to cover chapters 13, which is central nervous system, 14, peripheral nervous system, 15, autonomic nervous system, 16, special senses, and 19, the heart. So we're talking about the last chapter that's going to be on the test. All right? Then we're going to start talking about lymphatic system, but that won't be on the test. We'll start doing that maybe next week or maybe even on Wednesday. I'm not really sure. All right. So does anybody have any questions on the schedule or anything like that? No? Pretty good. What about the heart? Does anybody have any questions on the heart? No questions? Well, I guess I have questions then. How many layers does the heart have? Three. Yeah, from deep to superficial, what are they?
Endo, myo, epicardium,
right. And the epicardium has another name, the exact same structure, but it's got another name. It's the visceral pericardium, yeah, visceral pericardium, okay. And the pericardium, of course, is a serous membrane, but it has an additional layer that most serous membranes don't have, and that's the fibrous pericardium, the tough fibrous pericardium that surrounds the heart as well. All right, so how many chambers does the heart have?
Four,
and you know all the names. You could break them down into two sets. What would be the two sets? Atrioventricular and? Atrioventricular would be one set. And what would be the second set? How about semilunar? Semilunar at the roots of the pulmonary artery or the aorta, and the atrioventricular between the atria and ventricles, of course. Maybe you said right and left. That's one way of breaking it down, but I was thinking it more by structure, for instance, rather than just right or left side of the heart. Okay, last time, four chambers, four valves. Those are all good things to know. There's a separation. I think we talked about this last time. There's a separation between the atria and the ventricles. We call that the fibrous skeleton, and it's dense connective tissue, and it securely surrounds all four valves are in that plane so that the valves don't move around. It also prevents the valves from dilating because, remember, the cusps or the leaflets of the valves have to touch each other in order to close. And if the valves dilate, then the valve leaflets won't touch each other and they'll just flap back and forth and that form a valve. So that's an important thing. The other important thing is for electrical properties of the heart, and that's what we're going to talk about right now. So the fibrous skeleton electrically isolates, if we look at the slide on the right, it isolates electrical events in the atria from electrical events down in the ventricles. And these electrical events that we're going to talk about, which lead to the ECG, are the signals for contraction. All right, so electrical events are not synonymous with contraction, but they have to occur before contraction takes place. And because of the anatomy of the heart, both atria contract together simultaneously, followed by contraction of both ventricles. All right, so think of the atria contracting first, followed by the ventricles. And so that's a good reason why we have the fibrous skeleton separating the atria from the ventricles, because we want the atria to contract first before the ventricles. So if we look at just these cells right here, a histological section, what kind of tissue does this look like to you? I see what? I see these little striations. So if you see striations, you're going to be thinking muscle of some kind. Okay? But it could be confusing because you could think of two kinds of muscle. What would be the two kinds? Skeletal and cardiac. All right, so that's a really good hint, because what chapter are we in right now? Yeah, we're in the cardiac chapter, so guess what? These are cardiac cells. All right, now how would you know these are cardiac cells and not skeletal muscle? Because of these intercalated discs, these cells are relatively short. Skeletal muscle fibers are really long. They don't have intercalated discs. The other thing is that skeletal muscles are long and linear. They're not branched. But if we look at this cardiac muscle cell, we see that they are branched. All right, and that, if you can go from a very superficial layer of the heart wall down to very deep layers of the heart without having to cross any connective tissue layers. Right, you can just zip like a maze from one cell to the next, all the way from top to bottom. Now, these intercalated discs have two important features. Because these cells are short and the job of these cells is to contract, they should pull on each other, right? But they shouldn't pull apart. Because if they pull apart, then you're going to have a hole in the heart. All right, so there are special adherence junctions between these cardiac muscle cells so that they don't pull apart from each other at these intercalated discs. But there's something else that's really special. It has gap junctions. And these gap junctions are just pathways, are little holes between the myocardial cells right here that allow electrical information to hop from one cell into the next. Or let's just say from this cell right here into the next. And where does it go? It goes over to the next one. And then it can even, because these cells are branched, it can go down a layer, then hop to the next cell. And because they're branched, right, it goes down another layer, hops across, and does what? Goes right and left, and then even goes down to another deeper layer. So the heart only has to have one cell to become excited electrically, and what happens to all the cells in the heart? They become excited electrically as well, because that electrical signal can pass through these intercalated discs because they have gap junctions between them. So that's why the heart contracts as a unit. First the atria, and then the ventricles, because of gap junctions. Now, do you think skeletal muscle has gap junctions in it? Do you think? Why or why not? Because the heart contracts as a single unit, but what about your biceps, for instance? Do all the muscles in your biceps, all the muscle fibers in your biceps contract at one time when you give a voluntary command? No, they can't do that, right? So if you're going to lift up a piece of paper, only a few muscle cells in the bicep contract, but if you're going to lift up like a sack of potatoes, then what? All of them need to contract to lift a heavier weight. So if all those muscle fibers contracted when you lifted up something very light, like a piece of paper, what would happen? Well, you'd give yourself a bloody nose or a black eye, right? Or if all the muscle cells in your body had gap junctions, if you contracted one muscle, maybe in your finger, guess what would happen to all the muscles in your body? They all would contract, right? So that would not be very efficient, because we would just be all in contracture together at one time, not doing anything. So the heart is special because of these gap junctions. Okay, so there's a special conduction system in the heart that makes sure that the atria contract first before the ventricles, and we call that the conduction system. Okay, oh, here we can see these myocardial cells with the intercalated disc and the branched pattern. All right, but everything else about a myocardial cell is pretty much the same as a skeletal muscle cell, in that it has sarcomeres, right? It's got myosin and actin arranged just like in skeletal muscle. It's got sarcoplasmic reticulum that houses calcium that's released when there's an electrical signal flowing over the membrane of the cell, and that calcium then causes the sliding of these myofilaments past each other so that this muscle cell contracts. Okay, so it's very similar to skeletal muscle. All right, now here is, I believe this is an exam figure that shows the conduction system of the heart. And one interesting thing about the heart, and it's a lot different than skeletal muscle, the heart does not need electrical stimulation to contract. And it contracts on its own. It does have nerves going to it, but those nerves just adjust the rate of contraction and sometimes the force of contraction. So these little pathways that we see in yellow right here are special myocardial cells. These are muscle cells, but they don't contract like a normal muscle cell does. These just carry electrical information. They're specialized to act more like a nerve than a muscle. And cardiac muscle cells, all of these cells right here, will initiate contraction, will initiate an electrical stimulus, but there's one place in the heart that has the fastest rate, and that is the SA node, the sinoatrial node right here. These nodal cells will become excited electrically, periodically, but the rate is very fast, all right? And when these cells depolarize right here, that depolarization then goes from one cell to the next through those gap junctions, causing all of these muscle cells in the atria to contract. Okay, now that electrical signal can't get into the ventricles. Can anybody tell me the structure that prevents the electrical signals in the atria from jumping down into the ventricle right here? The fibrous skeleton, yeah, it's just connective tissue, like tendons and ligaments, they can't conduct electrical information. Only nerves and muscle cells do that efficiently. But here is a special pathway that can allow, it actually captures the electrical signal from the atria and passes it into the ventricle. The second structure in the conduction system right here is called the atrioventricular node, or AV node. And it's where? Right at the junction between the atria and the ventricle. And it passes through the fibrous skeleton right here. So this is what we call the atrioventricular bundle. And now that electrical signal is in the ventricle. Let's look and see how it gets in that ventricle in a little bit more detail. All right, so remember, excitation starts at the sinoatrial node, spreads into both atria, the atria's contract, and it finally then reaches this faraway point right here, the AV node. The AV node is kind of special because it holds on to the electrical signal for a split second, like a tenth of a second, and it doesn't pass it to the ventricle. So it holds on to the signal. So what does that allow the atria to do? Since it's holding on to the signal, the atria contract, and then that electrical signal moves from the AV node down into this AV bundle right here and then splits into a couple of branches that we call bundle branches. Okay? So at this point in time, now both atria have contracted. And what happens when the atria contract? It's a pump, right? It pumps blood. It pumps blood from where to where? From an atrium into the ventricle. And that makes perfect sense because we don't want the ventricles to contract unless they have what in them? Blood. And so it's the atria that help fill the ventricles up with blood so that when the ventricles do contract, they're actually pumping blood and not just contracting, using up energy. All right, so that electrical signal then, once it's into this AV bundle, it moves very fast all the way down to this part of the heart down over here. What part is this? The apex. So it goes through the septum very fast, and then the signal branches out through these little branches right here that we call Purkinje fibers, and that spreads that electrical excitation to the apex. And then this is the part of the ventricle that starts to contract first. The electrical signal then proceeds up the free wall of the ventricle to more Purkinje fibers, so then the next cranial division of the free wall contracts, and then the next superior division, and then the next superior division, and then the next superior division, so that the apical regions of the ventricles contract first before the basal regions. Now, why does that make sense? How does blood have to get out of the heart? Should it move from base to apex to leave a ventricle? Or is it going to move from apex to base to leave a ventricle? It's going to move from the apex up to the base, because here you see the great arteries at the base of the heart. So if the ventricles started to contract by the basilar regions right here, it would force blood down into the apex and it would have no place to go. So the conduction system does a number of things. And what we're talking about is that it contracts the apical regions, forcing blood up. Then these middle portions contract, forcing more blood up, and then the basal regions contract, forcing blood out of the ventricle into these arteries right here. Okay. So the conduction system is really important. It also does what we talked about. It allows for contraction of the atria first before the ventricle. So both atria contract, and then both ventricles contract a split second later. And The pathway that allows the electrical signal to move from the atria to the ventricles is this AV node and AV bundle. Okay. So that's pretty important. So make sure you know all these different components of the conduction system and know that these cells that make up the conduction system are really muscle cells, but they don't really contract. Their job is just to take electrical information from one place of the heart to the other. So that's pretty important. Okay. In your exam figures, I do want to say one thing. In your exam figures, let's see, this thing is an exam figure, but in your study guide, it says it's modified. And I'm not sure I mentioned that in lecture. So you have to know all these pieces of the heart, right? All the chambers and the valves and things like that. Right, and I see a number of blood vessels like the pulmonary veins right here, and you can see it's nicely oxygenated blood. But there are some blood vessels that are not labeled, and I want you to be able to label them for the exam. Okay, they should be labeled on this diagram, in my opinion, but they're not. And these are the blood vessels that branch off of the arch of the aorta. So let's look at the aorta. Where does the aorta get blood from? From the left ventricle. So the left ventricle pumps blood past the aortic semilunar valve, which is right here, into this first segment of the aorta. Okay, so how would we classify this first segment of the aorta? It starts right here at the semilunar valve, proceeds behind the pulmonary trunk, up to say about this region right here. That's the ascending aorta. Perfect. All right, and then we have the arch of the aorta. And then that automatically turns into the aorta that goes posterior to the heart down through the thoracic cavity. That's the descending aorta, right? So we got ascending, arch, and then descending, the thoracic division. And then the descending aorta, when it goes through the diaphragm, what does it become? It's still the descending aorta, but it would be the abdominal division of the descending aorta. We're going to look at that in the next chapter. So the vessels that I want you to know on this diagram are coming off the arch of the aorta, and it's this one, the first one, the second one, and third one. Okay, and so there's only three blood vessels, but they really, you should think of these as two groups. The first one and then the last two are going to do the job of the first one, but on the other side of the body. So this first blood vessel, maybe from lab you know, but I want to go over it explicitly. This is the brachiocephalic artery. And the name tells you a lot about that artery. Where is it going to take blood? Brachiocephalic means brachium to your arm, and cephalic means to your head. Now, what side of the body? It's only one side. It is the, okay? So remember, this heart is like you're looking at my heart inside my chest. All right? And so when I raise this hand, what hand is this? That's my right hand. So this is the right side of the heart. So this brachiocephalic is going to take blood to the right arm and right side of the head. Brachiocephalic. So the brachiocephalic will bifurcate to the subclavian and a common carotid artery in just a little bit right here. All right. This next branch does half the job of the brachiocephalic, but on the left side of the body. So this is the common carotid, or better yet, is the left common carotid. Goes to the left side of the head, your face as well as brain. All right. Huh? Left common carotid. Let's see if I can find a marker. Brachiocephalic. Now, is there a right or left brachiocephalic artery? There isn't, because there's what? There's only one, right? So if there's only one, we don't need to say right or left, but you should know that it's going to go to the right side of the body. I mention that because veins, you do have a right and left brachiocephalic vein. When we get into veins, you'll see that in the next chapter. All right, so brachiocephalic artery, that's the first branch off the aorta, and then the left common carotid. And what's that, an artery or a vein? That's an artery. And then we have the left subclavian. Where does that go? Yeah, it goes to the arm underneath the clavicle, so it's called subclavian artery. So that's how you spell carotid. Okay. And then the carotid, we're going to see bifurcates pretty soon into the internal and external carotid. One takes blood, the internal takes it to the brain, the external takes it to your face and scalp. Okay, so I want you to know these three blood vessels when you label this diagram for the test. Brachiocephalic, common carotid, right, and subclavian right here. And you know what? You should probably know what this is too. What's this down over here? That's the descending aorta, right? And maybe you could say thoracic division, right, but descending aorta. Okay. On these slides right here, I think it's pretty important to know. So here's a good trick question. What are the first branches off the aorta? What are the name of the arteries that branch off of the aorta first? Okay, maybe we went over this last time. That's good. You didn't get tricked. Because usually people think of the arch right here, but what have you forgotten about? The ascending aorta. There are blood vessels that come off of the ascending aorta really low, right inside the semilunar valves. And those arteries feed the heart. Okay? And there's two. There's a left coronary and a right coronary artery, which we can see right here. So here's an anterior view. I know this is anterior because here's that anterior longitudinal sulcus. Here's the left coronary that's coming off the ascending aorta, and then here is the right coronary that's coming off the ascending aorta. So the coronaries come off before the brachiocephalic does. Oh, look, this is nice. Too bad they didn't label this on the other diagram. Okay, brachiocephalic, left common carotid, left subclavian right here. Okay. All right, so what else do we have to say? Well, conduction system, I don't know, I think we talked about that pretty much. Let's go back to this picture right here. Okay, so we saw that electrical information, where does electrical stimulation of the heart, where does it begin in the normal heart? The right atrium, and what's that little spot in the right atrium called? It's the SA node or sinoatrial node. That's from the previous picture that shows the conduction system. Okay, that causes both atria to contract, that fills the ventricles up with blood. Okay, but remember that electrical signals can go from one myocardial cell to the next because of gap junctions. Okay, every once in a while when the heart is damaged or ischemic or not feeling well, that electrical signal gets disturbed, and instead of going from the SA node into the AV node, down the AV bundle, through the fibrous skeleton into the ventricles, it starts to wander around in the heart because it can do that. It can just go from one cell to the other. Okay, but usually the whole heart contracts as a unit, which means then the heart resets itself, it relaxes, and after a short period of relaxation, it can contract again. But every once in a while, sometimes that electrical signal can wander around, go from right to left, and then down, and then back up the posterior side, and then over to the left. And that electrical signal is the signal for contraction of a little ribbon of heart muscle, right? And when that happens, the heart is just going to kind of quiver, right? And we call that fibrillation. And when the heart is kind of quivering like that, guess what it's doing to blood in terms of pumping action? It's not really pumping any blood, right? Because in order to pump blood, what does the heart have to do? It's got to contract as a unit, right? But if it's just kind of quivering, it's not pumping blood, so blood is not coming out the aorta, it's not going up the brachiocephalic and carotid to your brain, right? So when the heart starts that process that we call fibrillation, it's not pumping, how much time do you have to remain conscious? Seconds. Yeah, we talked about this before. Because your brain is very active, it uses a lot of ATP, needs a lot of oxygen, so about 3 seconds worth of consciousness. All right, you pass out. And then, if the heart doesn't start contracting as a unit, if it stays in fibrillation, the brain is going to die. After what period of time? After about 3 minutes. Right? So that's why it's really good for you guys to know CPR, because what can you do for somebody whose heart is in fibrillation, not pumping blood, that's just kind of quivering? You can do chest compressions, and that compresses the whole heart, and that squirts some blood up into the aorta that perfuses the brain, right? And that can protect somebody's brain. They probably won't wake up, right? But that will at least protect their brain from dying until they can get to a hospital, or until maybe the paramedics come with an electronic defibrillator, right? The electrical paddles, which do what? It sends this big electrical signal into the heart. So what do all these muscle cells in the heart do? They all contract together, right? You force them to contract. They go into a period of relaxation, and hopefully then the SA node then can restart the normal heart rhythm when that happens. And that prevents that little current that's wandering around aimlessly through the heart, right, which causes fibrillation. So that's pretty important, okay, to be able to do that. All right, so that's fibrillation. Fibrillation is what? No coordinated contraction because synchronized depolarization is lost. It's just wandering around all over the place. And that electrical signal is just a signal for contraction. All right, but the heart is innervated. So here is the innervation of the heart. All right, is it going to receive voluntary nerves, somatic nerves, or autonomic nerves? Autonomic, because you can't really control your heart, right? Not like skeletal muscles. You can maybe influence it with meditation and stuff like that, or dreaming of certain things. You can speed it up or slow it down, but you can't really control it like skeletal muscle. And so it's the autonomic nervous system. And so how many divisions are there to the autonomic nervous system? This is a nice review for the test coming up on Thursday, a week from Thursday. There's two. And what are they called? The sympathetic and parasympathetic. And in terms of the heart, which one is excitatory, which one is inhibitory? Sympathetic is excitatory, and the parasympathetic is inhibitory. Now, does that make sense to have both nerves go to the heart? What do we call the relationship between parasympathetic and sympathetic? Antagonistic, right? And so it's very important, just like on your car, you got to have a gas pedal and a brake pedal to have control. In order to have control of the heart, you need both excitatory and inhibitory activity going to it. All right, so the parasympathetic can only adjust the rate of the heart, right? Not the force of contraction. This is kind of interesting, only the rate. So what do you call an instrument maybe that you would put on your arm to measure time or to keep track of time? A watch. What's a fancy name? A timepiece, right? And before you call it a timepiece, say throw in another $500, it's called a chronograph. Chrono means time. Graph means an instrument that, right, takes care of time for you, counts time for you. All right, so anytime you hear chrono, you should think of time, right? So parasympathetic has its effects on the timing of the heart, not force of contraction. And the parasympathetic innervation is carried by the vagus nerve. And you should know something about the vagus nerve. Is it a spinal nerve or cranial nerve? It's a cranial nerve. And then you should know what cranial nerve it is. What cranial nerve is it? It's number 10. And what could you do to prove that to yourself? You could say, on old Olympus's towering top, a fin in German, viewed a hop. All right, that's number 10. All right, vagus. Viewed for vagus right here. Okay, so you should know the number, the name, what it does. It goes to the SA node. What did we say the job of the SA node was? It's the pacemaker. Oh, I didn't say this, I don't think. It's the pacemaker, but it initiates the contraction of the heart, okay? When it receives parasympathetic stimulation from the vagus nerve, it slows down. And so that's going to slow your heart rate down because that's the pacemaker of the heart. Parasympathetics also go to the AV node. It slows down, if I go to the right-hand side, it slows down the transmission of that electrical information from the atria into the ventricles. Again, it just slows the heart rate down as a result. As opposed to sympathetic nerves to the heart. Okay, it comes from the medulla because that's where the cardioregulatory center is, right? And that's via what? Thoracic outflow. Now the sympathetic nerves go to the SA node and AV node just like the parasympathetic nerves do, but the effect is going to be different, right? It's going to speed the heart up. which is a chronotropic effect, again, just speeding the heart rate. But sympathetic nerves, if we look on the right, also go to the ventricles, and these are the cells that actually pump most of the blood out of your heart, these ventricles right here, and it causes them to contract with more vigor, stronger contractions. And that's what we call, on the left-hand side, an inotropic effect. So there are two ways your heart can be regulated to adjust the amount of blood it pumps. It could be the speed. It could be going from a slow contraction to a fast contraction. That's a chronotropic effect. But it can also be adjusted by the force. It could contract weakly, or it can contract strongly. Okay, that would be an inotropic effect. These two things are kind of independent from each other. Right, so chronotropy and inotropy are two different ways the heart can be regulated. And it is interesting that the parasympathetics don't adjust any of the force of contraction, cannot adjust the contractility of the heart, only the chronotropy of the heart, not the inotropy, but sympathetic can adjust both. All right, so that's pretty much it for the heart. I don't think I have anything else to say about the heart. Who's got a question? Any questions about heart so far? No, I think you guys are doing pretty good on the heart. All right, which then takes us to the circulatory system. And I think that's chapter 20 in your book. Indeed it is. All right, so let's talk about blood vessels in general. I suppose a blood vessel, of course, is carrying blood. And maybe a blood vessel you should break down into three major types of blood vessels. There are blood vessels that take blood away from the heart. There are vessels that bring blood back to the heart. And then you got some vessels that are in between those two. So make sure you can answer those questions in your mind. What kind of vessel takes blood away from the heart? Artery. Which kind bring blood back to the heart? That's a vein. And what's the kind in between? It's very special. It's microscopic, so you can't really see these, like you can arteries and veins. Those are capillaries, right? And an artery, we said the function of an artery is taking blood away. Function of a vein is bringing blood back to the heart. What's the function of a capillary? Exchange. That's the only place where things can enter or leave the circulatory system. And in this chapter, we're going to see why that is. Okay. And that's because blood vessels are made up of layers. Okay. And as a matter of fact, there are three main layers that make up blood vessels. You have the tunica externa, the tunica media, and tunica intima. And tunic just means a coat. I see some of you wearing coats today because it must be cold outside. Okay, so tunic is just a coat. And externa means what? The most superficial one. And the intima is the deepest one. This is the deepest layer. Okay, so here is a nice diagram right here, or illustration that shows all the layers in these three types of blood vessels. Okay, the tunica externa right here has a lot of collagen fibers associated with it. And collagen is what kind of fiber? It's really strong. Okay, and if this blood vessel over here that's in red, this is an artery. And this one in blue over here is a vein. And blood is a fluid. It's going to flow from one area to another based on a physical parameter. How does a gas or fluid move? What influences a gas or a fluid to move from one location to another? And that's pressure. Right, it is pressure. And how will it go? From one pressure to exactly the same pressure? Or from low pressure to high? Or from high to low? It's always going to go from high pressure to low. All right, so if blood flows from an artery into a vein, which one has a higher pressure, arteries or veins? Arteries have to have a much higher pressure. Otherwise, blood wouldn't flow in that direction. And since it has a higher pressure, the wall of an artery has to be bigger, thicker, and stronger. It's got to have a thicker tunica externa, right? It's got to have muscles. so that that high pressure doesn't blow that blood vessel up. Okay, but under certain circumstances, I suppose it still can. All right, so tunica externa, collagen fibers. Tunica media has these smooth muscles and some elastic fibers right here, which means what? When the heart pumps a lot of blood all of a sudden into that artery, some of these arteries that have elastic fibers can expand, right? And then those elastic fibers will contract down and keep blood flowing in one direction. Okay, so it has smooth muscle and elastic fibers. The tunica intima right here has three layers. Some more elastic. It's got an endothelium right here. This is a simple squamous epithelium that lines the blood vessel. And just like the endocardium, it's slippery and smooth. So how does blood flow through this vessel right here? Very easily, because that endothelium is really slippery and smooth. It shouldn't generate any blood clots, right? Now, if there are calcium deposits or something in a blood vessel, when blood flows over it, that could generate blood clots. And what could happen to that blood clot if it's in this blood vessel right here? It's going to travel until it gets to a small blood vessel, and then it's going to plug this blood vessel up, and then all this tissue that's being supplied by this blood vessel here is going to die as a result of it. Right? So you don't want clots in blood. And the endothelium is one layer that goes a long way in preventing that from happening. Then you have a subendothelial layer that helps attach the endothelium to this elastic and the tunica media right here. Okay, so that's an artery. Very thick, can withstand a lot of pressure. And then blood will flow into small arteries that we call arterioles. And blood then flows from arterioles into this microscopic structure right here that we call a capillary bed. And we can look at the structure of a capillary bed or a capillary within this bed right here. And it only has the tunica intima, and in particular only two of these layers. It has the endothelium and it's got a basement membrane. So which is thicker, a capillary or an artery? Artery, a lot thicker. And because an artery is so thick, things cannot move by diffusion from the blood into tissue spaces or from tissue spaces into the blood. Right? It's only in capillaries because they have one thin layer of cells, just a simple squamous epithelium. So that's why capillaries are specialized for exchange. Okay, then blood from all these capillaries will then join, or what we say anastomose, into this small vein right here, which is a venule, and then a bunch of venules come together to form a large vein, and of course that's going to bring blood back to the heart. A vein has all the layers that an artery has, but just not as thick. Right? So the tunica media is a lot thinner. This smooth muscle layer is not as thick, and even the tunica externa is not as thick as the tunica externa on an artery over here. There's another modification in this vein that I don't see in this capillary or this artery. What did we say the pressure in an artery was? Is high. So it's easy for blood to know which way it should flow in an artery because there's high pressure. It's going to flow into a vein, and the pressure in a vein is relatively low. And blood in a vein sometimes doesn't know which way it should go because its pressure is so low. It doesn't know if it should go up to the heart or maybe if it should go back down to an extremity somewhere. But there is a modification in veins that prevent the retrograde flow of blood. And I see it on this slide right here. And it's a structure that the heart has to make sure that blood flows only in an antegrade fashion through the heart, which means what? A forward direction, shouldn't flow backwards. And what do we call those things that regulate flow, blood flow, so it only can go in one direction? It's a valve. And that's what we see here in a vein. It has valves, so blood can only go back to the heart. If this is a normal individual with a normal vein right here, blood can only go back to the heart. And these valves are made from the same kind of tissue that makes valves in the heart. Can anybody remember what tissue makes valves in the heart? It's the endocardium. Okay, so valves are slippery and smooth too, just like the endocardium of the heart. All right, and look what makes valves and veins. It is the endothelium. Again, slippery and smooth, right? And it has cusps, and sometimes you can notice this in people, right? Like if somebody lifts up a really heavy weight, blood is going to try to go back down to the extremity, but these valves will close and it forms a bulge and a vein right there. And you can actually see those little knots or bulges in people's veins in their arms, right, when they're lifting weights and things like that. Now, that's a really good, healthy circumstance. But every once in a while, some people might get varicose veins or veins that are dilated, right? They're diseased, and so the diameter of a vein gets very big, and then what happens to these valves? They can't touch each other, and if they can't touch each other, they can't close. So that's really unfortunate for those people because blood doesn't always flow back to the heart. It can flow back down to their feet, right, and get stuck in their extremities. And if blood isn't flowing, that's when it has a tendency to form a clot. So that's a very dangerous circumstance when these valves don't work in people for varicose veins or other kinds of problems with veins. It can form thromboses or blood clots, which is like the last place you want to have a blood clot is in a blood vessel. Okay, so that's something interesting that a vein has. All right, so let's talk about the kinds of vessels in a little bit more detail. Okay, starting with arteries, with this slide on the right over here. On the left. Okay, I think we talked about most of these already. All right, so an artery takes blood away from the heart. It can be oxygenated or deoxygenated. Make sure you could give me an example of both. Like, give me the name of an artery that is carrying relatively deoxygenated blood. Pulmonary trunk, pulmonary artery, perfect example. Okay, arteries have the highest pressure because we want that blood to flow from an artery into a vein. They have elastic layers, and the largest blood vessels have the most elasticity. Like the aorta itself can really expand the diameter quite a bit. We call those conducting arteries. All right, smaller arteries are what we call distributing arteries. They don't have as much elastic, but they have much more muscle in the wall as well. Okay, because these blood vessels, when that muscle contracts, will vasoconstrict. And when those smooth muscles relax, they will vasodilate, and it is the sympathetic nervous system that can adjust the diameter of these blood vessels. And that is one way that the sympathetic nervous system adjusts for where blood is flowing in your body. So as a matter of fact, you have about 5.5 liters of blood in your cardiovascular system, and that's not enough to go everywhere in your body at one time. Your body has to pick where it's going to go. All right, and we did a little simulation in class, like the fight or flight response. Where does muscle go when the sympathetic activity is high, like under stressful circumstance? Where does blood go? Does it go to your digestive system? No, it doesn't. It goes to muscles, your brain, heart, things like that, right, so that you can deal with that threatening circumstance. So those blood vessels dilate. And what about blood vessels to your digestive tract under those circumstances? Those will vasoconstrict, and that will impede the flow of blood to that part of the body. All right, so changing the diameter of a blood vessel changes blood flow through an organ by a tremendous amount, and it changes by the fourth power rule. So what does the power mean? It just means it's an exponent. Right, the fourth power rule means that if we change the diameter of a blood vessel by a factor of 2, right, the flow through that vessel changes not by a factor of 2, but 2 multiplied by itself how many times? 4 times. So it's 2 times 2, which is 4, and then times 2, which is 8, times 2, which is 16. So small changes in the diameter of a blood vessel cause what? Major changes in blood flow through that vessel. That's just a physical principle of how tubes work. Or if the diameter changes by a factor of 3, only a factor of 3, what about blood flow? A factor of 81, right? A huge factor. Or if the diameter changes by a factor of 5, look at blood flow. It changes by a factor of 625. So your body can very efficiently control blood flow to various places by vasoconstriction or vasodilation. It's a very powerful way of doing that. Okay, and arteries can vasoconstrict or vasodilate, especially the small ones. These are arterioles. All right, they specialize to in functioning to regulate blood flow. And what's the easiest way to regulate blood flow in your body? By vasoconstriction or vasodilation. So arterioles can vasodilate, vasocontrol. Right, and it can happen by one of two ways, by local control or sympathetic tone. Sympathetic tone means it gets information from the sympathetic nervous system that will cause vasoconstriction. And local control just means that certain tissues will release compounds that will have an effect on smooth muscles of arterioles. So for instance, when a muscle is relaxed, like my biceps muscle is relaxed right now, it's not contracting, and is it using up a lot of oxygen if it's just sitting there relaxed? No. Okay, so it's high in oxygen because it's not using it up. And when a muscle is not exercising, it's not breaking down glucose to make ATP. All right, so glucose is at a high concentration. But when you start to exercise a muscle, guess what happens to oxygen? It goes down. And there is another compound that builds up when you use up oxygen. Actually, two molecules build up. Oxygen is converted into carbon dioxide. So now we have carbon dioxide building up in that muscle. And we also have buildup of a compound that you've heard of called lactic acid. All right, so as carbon dioxide builds up and lactic acid builds up, it can directly control these arterioles and cause them to vasodilate. And when that happens, is that good for the muscle or bad? We said that when a muscle starts to exercise, carbon dioxide goes up, but now because that causes vasodilation and you get a lot more blood there, what happens to that level of carbon dioxide? It washes out and oxygen concentration goes up, okay? And that's just an effect that happens in the muscle. Doesn't need nervous system innervation, so that's what we call local control. Local control adjusts the state of vasodilation of blood vessels just on the metabolic needs of that particular tissue. Right, so it doesn't even need a nervous system. Okay, there's something else that can adjust blood flow through a capillary network. And I think we want to look at this slide right here. So here we have an artery, high pressure. It's going to flow into this vein, which is low pressure, through this capillary network. But if we look at this capillary network right here, all right, so these are all just very kind of leaky blood vessels with a very thin one layer of endothelium. But guarding the entrance to each of these capillaries is a ring of smooth muscle. What do we call a circular skeletal muscle? Like around your eye?
Orbicularis,
right. Okay. Now, a circular smooth muscle, like we see right here, this is, I think, the first time that we're running into a circular smooth muscle. This is not under voluntary control. This is under autonomic control or local control by what's happening in the tissues right here. It can cause these cells to relax, which means this blood vessel is going to dilate. These circular smooth muscles are called sphincters. All right? They can constrict or dilate, and they adjust the flow through this capillary network right here. And since it's at the proximal end of a capillary, we call that a precapillary sphincter. Precapillary sphincters are regulated by the metabolic demands of this tissue right here, but also by sympathetic innervation as well. So when this tissue, if it was a muscle, is not activated, it's at a resting state, then these precapillary sphincters are contracted, and what does that do? That cuts off blood supply to this capillary because that tissue doesn't need oxygen and nutrients. And then blood just flows right through this, what we call a meta-arterial, directly from an artery to a vein to make sure that blood is always flowing, doesn't get backed up one way or the other. Okay, so if we look on the slide on the left over here, what controls blood flow through a capillary? Not through an arteriole, but through a capillary. It is the precapillary sphincter. Okay. Controls blood flow into capillary bed via local control. Okay. All right, capillaries. These are, if we look on over here on the right, these are the smallest blood vessels. And as you see, they only have a single layer of epithelial cells. So they're specialized for what kind of function? Exchange, right? And there are three different kinds of capillaries depending on how efficient they are in this exchange process. And the three types of capillaries are continuous, fenestrated, and sinusoidal. Fenestrated, continuous just means that the endothelial cells are right next to each other. Where one ends, another cell begins. Fenestrated just means that there are little windows between the cells. That's what fenestrations mean, means little windows, right? And sinusoids mean there are big gaps between the endothelial cells. So right here, I have the capillaries ranked by order of permeability or order of leakiness, which ones allow the most exchange. So of these three different kinds of capillaries, which one allows the most exchange? It would be the sinusoidal, right? And the one that allows for the least amount would be a continuous. And we're going to look in different parts of your body where they're located, okay? And since they have a different function, you should realize that they have a different shape associated with them. So let's see if I can find the picture of these different shapes of capillaries. I think they're all in one picture in your book, but I got them as three separate pictures. All right, so here is, now would you say this is a capillary or a vein or an artery, and why? Just looking at a nice transverse section of this blood vessel. I know it's a blood vessel because I see this red blood cell in here. Okay. A vein. Okay, but you said vein, which means like you were asking me a question. Okay. Well, that's a fair guess. But how many layers do I see? I see just one layer of endothelium right here. So it is a capillary. I don't see any tunica externa, tunica media. I don't see any I don't see any collagen. I don't see any elastic fibers, right? I don't see any smooth muscle. I just see this simple squamous epithelium right here. So this is a capillary, all right? And this one right here, where one endothelial cell ends, another one begins, right? It's separated by this really small space right here, but it's there are tight junctions that hold these cells together, all right? We just call this an intercellular cleft that allows for not the leaking of large things like red blood cells into the interstitial space, but what fluid can flow out of here, and small molecules like glucose and maybe sodium and potassium can leak out of a capillary bed. But that's okay because that's what a capillary is designed to do, right? To allow for some leakiness. All right, so this is a continuous capillary. Now, a fenestrated should have what? Bigger holes between the cells, like windows, okay? And here we see the fenestrations, right? We see that intracellular cleft, but now there are actually pores within the endothelial cells as well, and we call those fenestrations. So this kind of capillary is even more permeable. It allows for more exchange between the interstitial space and the blood, and or vice versa. Okay, and the movement of material is by pressure, right? So there's low pressure in the interstitial space, high pressure in the capillary, so things will leave, and also by a concentration gradient. And molecules will move, just like pressure, from high concentration to low through these fenestrations. If it's high in the plasma and low in the interstitial space, then that material will leave the blood. But if it's high in the interstitial space and low in the blood, then things will enter. So that's how things move in the capillary. And the third kind of capillary is the sinusoid. And look at the big holes, the big spaces, a large intercellular cleft. All right, and these fenestrations right here are really huge. And as a matter of fact, this basement membrane, superficial to the endothelium, is incomplete as well. All right, so that barrier is removed. So this is the leakiest kind of capillary. We're going to see that this is the kind that we have in the liver, for instance, which actually filters a lot of blood. Blood actually leaves these capillaries. It flows through different spaces in the kidney and then is returned to the circulatory system. All right, so that's the most permeable. So those are the three kinds of capillaries. And then capillaries will join together or anastomose to form venules. These are small veins. And then venules will anastomose to form large veins. And what's the function of a vein? It brings blood back to the heart. Okay, maybe oxygenated or deoxygenated. Give me the name of a vein that's carrying deoxygenated blood. Deoxygenated. Would it be pulmonary or systemic? It would be a systemic vein, right? And what's the name of a good systemic vein that's carrying relatively deoxygenated blood? Inferior vena cava, superior vena cava. Yeah, jugular. We're going to look at some of these, okay? And then give me the name of a vein that's carrying oxygenated blood. Is there such a thing? That sounds so weird. With the pulmonary veins, not weird at all, because blood is coming back from the lungs and they pick up oxygen in the lungs, right? So the pulmonary veins are highly oxygenated, all right? And since blood flows from an artery into a vein, veins have the lowest blood pressure. A lot of times students think, if we look at this slide over here back on the right, a lot of times students say, if I ask them, what blood vessel has the lowest blood pressure? Students are going to say capillaries, because capillaries are specialized for exchange. But what would happen if capillaries have the lowest blood pressure? Where would blood go? Would flow, all the blood in veins would flow into a capillary, all the blood in arteries would flow into a capillary, and then no blood would ever flow back to the heart, right? So capillaries would get bigger and bigger and bigger because all the blood is flowing into it, and then they would just go pop and there'd be a big mess, right? So that's not true. The lowest blood pressure is in a vein, which then takes blood back to the heart. Okay, but since the blood pressure is so low, these devices, these veins, have to have special things associated with them so that blood flows in one direction. So it only flows back to the heart. And what are those things called? Those are valves, right? And then you kind of looked and saw where those are. Okay, and since that blood pressure is so low in a vein, we might want to ask, how does it find its way back to the heart? Well, there are little pumps that work along veins, all right, that move blood along in one direction. And the two pumps are the respiratory pump and the skeletal muscle pump. So let's talk about these two concepts, skeletal muscle pump versus respiratory pump. Okay, and I think I have a picture somewhere around in here that shows it. Where's the picture at? I don't see it. I might have to find it and show it to you next time. But I want to here. Okay. So here we have a blood vessel. What kind of blood vessel is this right here? Is that a capillary? It's a vein. Yeah, very good. How do you know that's a vein? It's got valves. Plus it's blue probably, right? Okay, but that doesn't matter because it could be, right, it could be a pulmonary artery or something, right? It's blue. All right, but it's got valves. So that is a vein. And on either side of this vein, we have what? Skeletal muscle, all right? And when skeletal muscle contracts, what happens to it? Like this biceps right here. What's it doing? What's it? Well, it's shortening, but what else is it doing? Come on. It's bulging. Come on, it's bulging. All right, it's bulging. It's getting big and thick, right? Okay. So this muscle is contracting. It bulges, and when it bulges, look what it's doing. It's pinching this blood vessel right here, which is a vein. And when it squeezes down on that segment of the vein, what happens to the pressure in this little segment right here? It goes up. All right, so blood is going to want to squirt from between these two muscles because they're bulging like that, and it's going to want to squirt back down to the periphery or squirt back up to the heart, but which way can it squirt only? It can only go up because of this valve right here. So that's typically what you see with people lifting weights, right? A little knot right there, so blood is actually squirting back up if that valve is causing the blood to squirt back to the heart. So this is what we call the skeletal muscle pump. So it's actually pretty important that people get exercise, right? Especially if they have vascular disease of veins right here, because what does that do? That helps return blood to the heart. That improves their circulation, okay? And there are people that have problems with this, even with normal blood vessels, right? If you're on a long airplane flight from, like, the east coast of the United States to the left coast, I mean west coast, okay, what should you do during that flight, which could be 5 or 6 hours? You should get up and walk around, and what will that do? That will help your circulation, because the last thing you want is for blood to start to pool in your extremities. What will blood have a tendency to do if it pools? To form a clot, right? And then it's going to float around. And this has actually happened to a lot of people on some of these transcontinental flights, a blood clot, and that blood goes, where does that blood go from the, this, here's a nice systemic vein. Here's a systemic vein. Where does that take blood to? What part of the heart? Right atrium into the right ventricle, then into then these are all big spaces, so blood can't get, the clot can't cause any problems there, because these are all big blood vessels, right? Then from the right atrium to the right ventricle into the pulmonary artery, which is a big artery. Now the blood vessels start to get small because they start to branch, all right? So they form arterioles in the pulmonary circuit, and then capillaries in the lungs are really, really tiny. And that's where those blood clots can get stuck and block off various parts of the lung. And then what happens to that part of the lung? It dies. All right? We call that pulmonary embolism. And you certainly can die of pulmonary embolism, all right, when that happens. There was a news reporter during one of the Gulf Wars in the Middle East not too long ago, maybe 10 years ago. He was in a Humvee, and they were just too scared to get out because they're going to get shot at, right? So he stayed in a Humvee sitting down the whole time, and he got a pulmonary embolism because he wasn't exercising these skeletal muscle pumps right here, right? So that's something that you should consider when you're on a long airplane flight. That could happen to you too. Or if you fly from here to like Denpasar or someplace like that, which is like a 16-hour flight. Where's Denpasar? Who knows where that is? Anybody know where that is? Nobody? That's Bali. You should go to Bali sometime. Okay? Or Australia, someplace really far away. Make sure you exercise to get what? Your circulation going. All right, so that's the skeletal muscle pump. All right? There's something else that happens too. Okay. And this is what we call the respiratory pump. All right? So how does air move in and out of your lungs? How does any fluid move from one area to another? It's by what? It's by pressure. And how do things flow? From high pressure to low. When air flows into your lungs or into your thoracic cavity, what's the pressure in your thoracic cavity, high or low? Okay, it's got to be low. In order for air to flow in, it's got to be low. And when air flows out, it is high, right? High, low. So not only is air flowing in and out of your thoracic cavity, blood actually flows in and out of your thoracic cavity. When you inhale, what's the pressure inside your thoracic cavity? When it's flowing in, it's low inside your thoracic cavity. So not only is air flowing into your thoracic cavity, but blood from your extremities gets sucked into your thoracic cavity. Where's your heart? It's in your thoracic cavity. So when you are inhaling, blood flows back to the heart. Okay, and when you exhale, what's the pressure inside your lungs, your thoracic? It's high, air flows out, but now why doesn't blood flow out of your thoracic cavity to the extremities when you exhale? Why is that? Because what do veins have? They have valves. So when you inhale, that enhances the return of blood to your heart. When you exhale, blood doesn't flow back to your extremities because of these valves right here. Right, as long as you have a healthy cardiovascular system. So that's what we call the respiratory pump that returns blood to your heart. And what's the second pump called? Skeletal muscle pump, right? When you get those muscles bulging like that. Okay, so that's something about venous return. Don't forget about those two pumps. So next time we're going to start with pulmonary circulation and look at some anatomy of the pulmonary circulation. But go ahead and review layers. Okay, so that's it for today. Except if you have lab yet.